You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, and welcome to the Art of History podcast. My name is Amanda Matta. I have a degree in art history, and today I have a really strong desire for it to be spring already. Where I live, it's been like 65 degrees the past 2 days, which I have determined is my optimum operating temperature. Like, it needs to be 65 every single day, and I would be happy. But it's only March also, so that's also a little bit terrifying. But how to segue out of that existential dread-inducing thought. We are well and truly into 2024, if you're listening to this episode in real time, which means, for those of you who follow me on Instagram, personally, on my page, Matta of Fact, this is not new information, but for the rest of you, you might not know, in about 90 days, I am hosting a trip to Scotland, which you can still sign up for. There are still spots available to join me. I will post a link to that in the description. And yeah, I think under 100 days is fair game to start a countdown. So that is what I will be doing immediately after finishing recording here, I think, because I'm really excited. I love Scotland, and I'm excited to get traveling again in 2024. My trip to Ireland was incredible, jump-started me, like, I'm back in the saddle, you know? I cannot wait to be back museuming and castling, looking at castles. I'm really excited. So if you'd like to join me, I will put all the information you need in the description. You can check out the itinerary, and I hope to see you there. Today's episode does take us to the British Isles, not to Scotland, unfortunately, but we are looking back at British history through a different lens than what we typically do. So I'm really excited for this episode and for you to hear it, because today we are looking at how the daughter of an African ruler became goddaughter to one Queen Victoria. I know, crazy. Before we dive in today, just your cursory reminder, if you are enjoying the podcast, send it to a friend that you think needs a little artistic enrichment in their life. Send it to your mom, send it to my mom and say, hey, your daughter's doing great, if you know my mom. Don't do it if you don't know her. That would be weird. You can also not contact my mom at all and give the show a nice rating and review. That would really help me get in front of new listeners, because we have some exciting stuff on the schedule for 2024 and beyond. So every listen helps, and I love you all just for being here and tuning in. If you are new to the show, welcome. The premise here is so simple. Every episode, we take a look at history through a work of art. I did not say that the same way I said it in every other episode so far, and it's really bugging me. each episode we wait, what is it? Okay, I had to literally pull up my Google Docs. Each episode I select a work of art that can tell us a story about the past. There you go. So we use paintings and the sculptures and architecture sometimes as a lens into history, and it's a lot of fun. So welcome. I hope you enjoy. I'm really not doing a good job of selling this. I should just get into the meat of today's episode, huh? Okay, so today we are starting our story in West Africa, where a girl named Amoba Aina was born in 1843. Now, she later goes by a different name, but I will call her Aina throughout this episode because I think that is how she wanted to be addressed. That's how maybe she referred to herself. So she's going to be Aina, even though in popular history, she is often called Sarah Forbes Bonetta. And the work of art that we're going to be centering this episode on today is a portrait of her, and it's titled Aina Sarah Forbes Bonetta Davies, and it was painted in 2020. So we are very contemporary in terms of our artwork, but our subject was born in 1843. And of course, we'll get to how this painting came to be created a little later in the episode. But if you're looking to research, well, not research, you're listening to a podcast, but if you're looking to see the portrait, it is by an artist called Hannah Uzor, U-Z-O-R, and it was painted in 2020. So if you're looking for a visual link as I give you Aina's biography, that is going to be it. So yeah, we're just going to dive right into her story, her biography, and we'll go from there and see what comes up, because this is a fascinating story with really, really interesting, broad, like, implications for how we talk about history. So have I mentioned I'm excited? So this girl named Amoba Aina was born in 1843. Most mentions of her leave it at she was the daughter of a West African ruler. But okay, more specifically, Aina is believed to have been a titled or a royal member of the Egbado clan, which is now called the Yewa. This is a group of people that actually belongs to a larger distinction known as the Yoruba people from West Africa. Today, they mainly inhabit parts of Nigeria, Benin, and Togo. Now, the Yoruba people at this time, they had an empire of their own. So even though we are centered in the era of, you know, we think of the British Empire and this trade empire that they have carved all over the world, in West Africa, the Yoruba had an empire of their own. They had subjugated a territory in present-day Benin called Dahomey, the Kingdom of Dahomey. In 1823, King Gezo of Dahomey refused to pay his annual tribute money to the Yoruba, which sparked warfare. He was just not having it anymore, I guess. And so by the time that Aina was born 20 years later, this war had fractured the Yoruba Empire in question into many, many smaller states, each with their own leaders. So she was the daughter of one of these leaders, one of these kings. Many people would refer to her as a princess. We don't know what her exact, you know, title or distinction would have been, but it's safe to say she would have been treated as a princess. When Aina was 5 years old, her parents were killed in an attack on the Egbado people's territory in this war with the Kingdom of Dahomey. So she is orphaned. Many people who were caught up in this warfare were either killed or captured by the Dahomey Kingdom, and many of them were sold into the Atlantic slave trade, because the King Gezo of Dahomey, we're going to get to him in a little bit, he was pro-slavery. Even though he was a West African king, slavery was something that was traditional to an extent within his culture, and the way he viewed it was, you've conquered a people and you get to enslave them. That was kind of his view. So Aina herself, she was taken as a slave by King Gezo and his army and his supporters, and taken back to his court. The reason for this, because everyone else that was captured in this conflict was either killed or, you know, sold. Evidently, people with a noble or a royal status in the Egbado clan, they had specific markings on their face that they wore, which distinguished them as being, you know, set above everyone else. So when King Gezo and his men saw Aina and her special markings on her face, they gave her quote-unquote special treatment. They transported her with them instead of selling her abroad or outright killing her. So yeah, special treatment. Now, just a word on the relationship between Britain and West Africa and the slave trade in the time that we are in, 1848. Between 1662 and 1807, British colonial ships purchased, according to the Royal Museums of Greenwich, an estimated 3,415,000 Africans. Of this number, almost 3 million of them survived what was called the Middle Passage and were sold into slavery in the Americas. So about 40 years earlier, you know, slavery was running rampant, and the trade routes between Africa, Britain, and the New World, such as they were dominated by transporting humans into enslavement. Only Portugal and Brazil transported more Africans across the Atlantic than Britain. However, in 1807, British Parliament had passed legislation to end the British slave trade. So by the time that Ina is being captured in West Africa, the slave trade has been abolished by Britain for 40 years, 41 years. This had actually been a long time coming for Britain. They had begun toying with the idea of abolishing the slave trade as early as 1776, when the House of Commons debated a motion that, quote, "the slave trade is contrary to the laws of God and the rights of men." There is absolutely no way that I can summarize for you like almost a century of abolitionist efforts, but just know that this was like a really long, hard-fought struggle, and it took on this moral tone where it was like a battle for good and evil in the minds of people who were, I mean, it really is, but you know, that was how people saw it who were debating for the end to the slave trade and to slavery. It was this like moral crusade at the time. So British slavery never took place on like their home turf. It never happened within the borders of England itself. Enslaved peoples were largely transported to the Caribbean, 3,000 miles away instead. And it is also worth noting that the trade of slaves ended in 1807, right? But this did not put an end to slavery itself in British colonies. The passage of the legislation that would do that, the Slavery Abolition Act, would not come until 1834. And at that time, that act freed 800,000 enslaved people in the British colonies. So that has happened 10 years before Ina has been taken captive, right? So that's where we are, like, chronologically. For context, because whenever I talk about this with somebody who's British, they love to tell me that Britain did it before America. And that is true. That is absolutely 100% true. But for context, America actually followed in Britain's footsteps relatively quickly in terms of outlawing the trade and importation of slaves. They outlawed it in 1808, so a year later, the slave trade in America was abolished and it became illegal to import enslaved peoples. And now there was, of course, smuggling that took place, and slavery itself was a condition that kept persisting until much longer than it did in Britain. It would take, of course, until 1865 in America for us to abolish the practice of slavery, and it happened on our home soil. So yeah, that's not great for us. But Britain at the time really did have this view that they had had this problem like neatly sorted out for a long time. I mean, by 1848, we've still got slaves actively in America, and they've not only abolished both the slave trade and active slavery in their colonies, but now, 10 years later, they've taken on this mission to make sure that the slave trade and slavery became abolished in the rest of the world. So that was their current crusade. And that's what leads to this intersection of the British and the Kingdom of Dahomey in 1848, when Ina has been taken captive by King Gezo. Now, I mentioned that King Gezo, he has this attitude towards enslavement and slavery, that it's traditional and it's part of, I mean, really, it's part of his heritage and the way that things are done. So King Gezo tells British envoys who visit him that, quote, "the slave trade has been the ruling principle of my people. It is the source of their glory and wealth. Their songs celebrate their victories, and the mother lulls the child to sleep with notes of triumph over an enemy reduced to slavery." So there's this idea that when you are victorious, it is your right to enslave your enemy. So even after the UK, the British, have abolished the slave trade, they are encountering this West African ruler who is literally fighting against their efforts to prevent him from exporting his own slaves and from, you know, enslaving his enemies and people he's conquered. So it's just a very, I don't want to say strange situation, but it's not what we always hear from history. In, I just wrote 18, I'm going to assume it's 1848, King Gezo was visited by one Royal Navy captain named Frederick Forbes, who was, quote, a representative of Queen Victoria on a mission to negotiate the suppression of slavery. And he came basically to try and convince King Gezo to stop selling people into the transatlantic slave trade. Because as I said, slaves, even though the imports into America and British colonies had been stopped, there was still a slave trade. There was still smuggling that happened, etc. Now, Captain Forbes, bless him, was completely unsuccessful in trying to convince King Gezo of this. And according to his own account, he wrote in a journal that he actually witnessed one of the traditional quote-unquote uses that the Kingdom of Dahomey had for these enslaved captives, these conquered peoples. So this was a sacrificial practice called watering the graves, in which the enslaved captives, people who had been held, I think he wrote that they were held in cages, would be carried out to the graves of Dahomey ancestors. And there they would be beheaded, and their blood would kind of be poured on the graves and would soak into the ground as what the Dahomey people saw as a tribute to their ancestors. So our little Ina is one of the captives who is brought out while Captain Forbes is visiting King Gezo. And she is set to be one of the captives who are going to be sacrificed in this practice. Evidently, it was her high status that kind of destined her for this fate. You know, her face markings had told King Gezo and his men that she was of high status, so therefore she would be a fitting tribute. Captain Forbes wrote that in Dahomey it was, quote, usual to reserve the best born for the high behests of royalty and the immolation on the tombs of the deceased nobility. So she's kind of considered a fitting sacrifice here. Forbes takes notice of her, I think because she is the smallest, and, you know, she's a child, she's the smallest of all these captives, she's absolutely pitiful in his eyes, and Forbes's greatest discomfort with this practice seems to be that Ina is included as one of the people to be sacrificed. He sees, in his mind, King Gezo essentially murdering a tiny helpless child, and not, you know, she was a young girl, he would have had this paternalistic instinct kick in on top of his feelings about, like, West Africans engaging in the slave trade. So there's a lot going on here. I think it's important to note that it is paternalism here that is causing him to intervene and take notice of Ina, because the rest of the group of prisoners is still led to their deaths, and he watches some of them be beheaded. So there's that. But because this is a diplomatic mission, Captain Forbes appeals to King Gezo using Ina, and he says that Queen Victoria, who has sent him, would never honor a king who could take it upon himself to kill an innocent child. Now that's, again, that's a lens that we can all agree on. Yeah, that's bad. At the time, the King of Dahomey would not have seen it that way. He would have seen this as his right. But King Gezo offers Ina to Captain Forbes, who accepted her as a tribute, basically, saying that Ina would be a present from the King of the Blacks to the Queen of the Whites. He wrote in his journal that refusing to take Ina would have been, quote, to have signed her death warrant, which probably would have been carried into execution forthwith. So he's saying, if I didn't take her, she would have been killed, like, right in front of me. Forbes and King Gezo had already exchanged, like, many material gifts, so Ina, who is now 6 years old, is often described just kind of as being presented as a diplomatic gift to Captain Forbes. The whole ritual sacrifice story is often left out of her biography. I kind of had to go looking for it, but, you know, it is what it is. So after saving Ina from being sacrificed, Forbes, again, he has this paternalistic view of her. He takes her in, he baptizes her, and he gives her a new Anglican name. He calls her Sarah Forbes Bonetta. Now, he gives her his own last name, supporting the view that he kind of took her in, planning to have her be like one of his own children. But the name Bonetta is a bit more iffy, because Forbes had sailed to West Africa on a ship called the HMS Bonetta. So you're stripping her original name, stripping her symbolically of her West African identity, replacing it not only with your own surname, like, you're a white man, you're giving this black child your own surname, but you're also giving her the name of the ship that you are going to carry her away from her home on. So I know that Captain Forbes's mission is to, like, prevent the spread of slavery and the spread of the slave trade even farther, you know, stop it once and for all. But I'm chewing on this question of how is this any different? I mean, it is different in practice because Ina is going to face a much better life than the enslaved people who went before her a generation ago. But in replacing her name and stripping of her identity, like, this is no different than the issues of identity that are faced by enslaved people who never knew their birth names. So it's just, again, we're in very, very tricky territory here. And that is something we're going to address time and time again. Forbes and Ina, I'm going to keep calling her Ina just because I think that's the best choice here. They live in West Africa for a year, and then they get on the HMS Bonetta to travel back to England. Forbes is teaching her English, he's educating her a little bit, and he notes that on the voyage back to Britain, Ina became, quote, a general favorite with the crew, who called her Sally. So her given Christian name is Sarah. They have given her a nickname that is Sally. So she's got all these names now. Forbes and his crew and Ina arrived in England on November 5th, 1850. And Ina has had, I would guess, no say in the matter. Which, again, it's very ironic because Forbes and Britain as a whole have embraced this mantle of, you know, they're the champions that ended slavery and ended the slave trade, but you still have this young African girl being taken away from her homeland without having any input. So Forbes himself would not have made this connection because, again, this form of transporting somebody out of West Africa, in his mind, it's so different than the abhorrent conditions of slavery that Ina would have been subjected to like half a century earlier. And this is just the first of what the curatorial director for English Heritage calls a number of interesting and quite uncomfortable things around colonial attitudes to Ina. This is a woman named Anna Evis who says, quote, she was viewed as a specimen of what a Negro woman could become with the right patronage. And we see that kick off almost immediately. Captain Forbes is quoted saying about Ina that she is a perfect genius. She now speaks English well and has great talent for music. She is far in advance of any white child of her age in aptness of learning and strength of mind and affection. I think because of this, because of how he regards Ina as being like a prodigy among Africans, soon after arriving in England, Forbes introduces her to Queen Victoria at Windsor Castle. He presents her to the Queen. Now, at this first meeting, Ina is tasked with giving Queen Victoria an account of her life. So she tells her how she had been taken prisoner by King Gezo, how she and other captives were held in crowded cages, and how they knew that they would only be released if they were going to be sacrificed. So this is, Queen Victoria loved to hear stories like this, and she loved to be told how she, as a good, benevolent queen overseeing, you know, the end of slavery, was helping these people and how she was on the right side of history, so that she would have eaten this up. And indeed, after this meeting, Queen Victoria wrote in her diary that, quote, Captain Forbes saved her life by asking for her as a present. She was brought into the corridor. She is 7 years old, sharp and intelligent, and speaks English. She was dressed as any other girl. The Queen was so taken with this young child that she decided she would become her godmother. She requested that Ina have her photo taken after their visit. So the girl was taken to a London photography studio. This was the American photographer John J. Myall. Now, photography was an entirely unfamiliar practice to Ina, and there's an account of her being so afraid of the photographer because he had no idea what she wanted and what all this machinery around her was. This account says that when Ina noticed a portrait of a man holding a sword hanging on the wall, she became panicked, and onlookers assumed that this was because of her time spent in captivity. She would have associated swords, like, entirely with beheadings. She apparently yelled, "Cut head off," and ran her hand down her throat. It was necessary to reassure the trembling girl that the man holding the sword in the picture was not real and would not hurt her. I'm not sure if I fully buy this story. We always have to take with a grain of salt who is writing, what's the audience that they're writing for. And when it comes, again, to stories about a young Black child being brought to Britain and being essentially assimilated, you know, you kind of have to take these stories with a grain of salt because it reeks with paternalism. Like this tone of, oh, a silly child wouldn't have known any better because of her upbringing, because of where she came from, but we are going to educate her. And I just go back to, you know, Queen Victoria wrote in her diary that she was sharp and intelligent. Forbes wrote that she was far in advance of any white child of her age in aptness of learning. But like, what if she hadn't been, you know, like what if he had rescued this girl and she wasn't a natural born learner? You know, what if she was just average? What if she was so scared that she could never make any progress in Britain? Like, would they still have made this effort and taken her, like would the Queen have taken her under her wing? We'll never know. But there's this sense that she's a deserving person of all this attention, kind of in the background of all of this. So just all these things, once again, going on, all of these lenses. So Captain Forbes, unfortunately, passes away later that year. I think this is 1851, probably from malaria. And so Queen Victoria took on all of Ina's financial expenses. She essentially became her guardian. She made sure that she had a place to live. And Ina spent her time kind of moving between Windsor Castle and school. The Queen paid for her attendance at school and paid for her education. At age 8, though, Ina developed this chronic cough, and it was thought that that was because of the damp climate in England. You know, she's grown up in West Africa, very different climate than the dampness of rainy old England. So for her health, Ina is sent to a church missionary school in the African country of Sierra Leone. She appears there in the school register as not Sarah, but Sally Bonetta. She's pupil number 24. So she's apparently going by this nickname once again of Sally. The intention at this school was that Ina should become educated and eventually become a Christian missionary herself. Queen Victoria sent her presents and books while she was at school, but apparently Ina was unhappy at the missionary school in Sierra Leone, and at age 12, she returned to England. She was put into the care of Reverend Frederick Schoen and his wife Elizabeth, who were, incidentally, former missionaries who now lived in Gillingham, Kent. So Ina continued her education there with them. And there is always also this undercurrent of religion to Ina's education, and that is intentional because I think of the attitudes of her white benefactors. There's this suggestion that their interest in her, again, it's not entirely altruistic, it is entirely linked to their attitudes as Christian missionaries and this idea of wanting to see Black individuals improve themselves to like earn a place in good society. And the press at this time, the media, is also picking up on Ina, and they're following her education very closely. They were, quote, keen to discover what light her achievements could shed on racist beliefs then widely held about the intellectual inferiority of African people. So she's essentially this, like, specimen, this experiment. And you hate to think, like, if she cracked under the pressure, if she wasn't, again, a natural student, what would have happened? Would she have been abandoned? Like, I don't know. Luckily, that's not something Ina has to worry about. She became fluent in French. She was taught, quote, the mannerisms of how to be a lady in upper class English society. And again, she had this particular talent, they say, in music. So she was very musically inclined. All the while, Queen Victoria is keeping up contact with Ina. According to the Schoen's daughter, Annie, who helped to educate her, Queen Victoria, quote, gave constant proofs of her kindly interest in her. At the midsummer and Christmas seasons, she often went either to Windsor or Osborne to stay in the family of one of the officers of Her Majesty's household, and was frequently sent for by the Queen to be seen privately. She goes on, she generally returned to us with very pleasant remembrances of these visits, and nearly always with some handsome present from the Queen. On one occasion, it was a beautiful gold watch, at another time, a handsome turquoise ring. One beautiful gold bracelet she had was engraved with the words, from Queen Victoria to Sarah Forbes Bonetta. So at this point, we've kind of had this transition, right? Ina's life is no longer up in the air. She's really firmly established as a godchild of Queen Victoria, as this young woman who is kind of coming into upper-class British society.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
The Royal Collection Trust has a photograph of Ina from around this time. It's dated 1856 and it's captioned Sally Benetta Forbes. So perhaps she was going by Sally in her kind of like private intimate circles. I will post this picture on the Instagram. I just remembered I did not mention it at the top of the episode, but over on the Instagram, I will have the portrait that we're talking about today and a bunch of supplemental images for you to look through. So head over to Art of History Podcast on Instagram to take a look. So in this photograph, Ina is shown kind of from the knees up. She's seated, she's facing the viewer, and she's resting her right arm on this little table. The table has, I think it's a basket with some cloth in it. So again, very respectable for a young lady. She's wearing this pinstriped dress, hoop earrings, and a chain link bracelet. You can also see if you zoom in, she's wearing a small, like, it looks like a tartan head covering over her hair. You can see the texture of her hair. She's absolutely beautiful. And you can just make out a small little tassel hanging from her head covering by her left ear. So I think that's a nice detail. Ina continued to remain close with Queen Victoria throughout her entire life. She attended two of Queen Victoria's daughters' royal weddings and many high society events. The Queen would often send her clothes to wear to these events, so that's nice of her, I guess. One of the weddings she attended was the wedding of Princess Alice in 1862. Princess Alice, incidentally, would later give birth to Princess Alix of Hesse, but you probably know her better as Empress Alexandra Feodorovna of Russia. So, you know, the last Empress of Russia married to Tsar Nicholas II. Yeah, that's how close Queen Victoria is related to all of these other monarchies of Europe. Just thought I would throw that little fun fact in there. It was possibly at this royal wedding or at a high society function much like it that Ina met the man that she would eventually marry. His name was Captain James Davies. He was a Sierra Leone-born businessman, and Ina would marry him in 1862 when she was 19 years old. Unfortunately, this is another life event that we don't really know. Well, we kind of know how Ina felt about this, but we don't really know entirely her motivations here. We can guess. So I'll just give you kind of what I know and we can puzzle through it together. So a lot of the language in Ina's biographies say that she obtained permission from the Queen to marry Captain Davies, or that the Queen gave her permission. Some of them even say that Ina was commanded to marry the Queen, or to marry Davies by the Queen. So we got a real mixed bag of language here. Davies was a Yoruba man, so they come from kind of the same group, the same background. His parents were liberated slaves, but through his own business dealings, he'd become considerably wealthy on his own merit. And at this time, he was prominent in abolitionist social circles. He was first a teacher in Sierra Leone at the kind of the boys' version of the missionary school that Aina had attended. And he worked his way up the ranks in the British Navy's West Africa Squadron before settling down as a merchant. And that's how he made his money. So at this time, Aina is being encouraged to accept his proposal. It's said that Captain Davies first saw Aina at one of these high society events that she's now attending as part of the royal circle and declared an interest in marrying her. And Aina is being encouraged to say yes. This is one instance, there are very few of them, where we actually know how she feels directly. She wrote in a letter to Annie Shone, no, to Elizabeth Shone, the mom. She said, quote, "Others would say, he's a good man, and though you don't care about him now, you'll soon learn to love him. That, I believe, I could never do. I know that the generality of people would say he is rich, and marrying him would at once make you independent, and I say, am I to barter my peace of mind for money? No, never." So, we do know how she felt about this. It sounds like she had her misgivings about Captain Davies. She was not in love with him. But it also sounds like Queen Victoria thought this would be a good match, and you can see why she would have thought that. They come from the same area of West Africa. They attended the same school. These are both people who have been influenced by the Christian Missionary Society. Queen Victoria would love, she would ship this. She would love for them to get together. And so Aina and Captain James Davies were married on August 14th, 1862, in a ceremony officiated by the Bishop of Sierra Leone. So that's nice. That's a really high profile get for your wedding. And it is an encouraging little tidbit here, because what you don't see in Aina's story is a complete erasure of her African heritage and her African connections. You do see that brought into her story over and over, and you see this continuation of her connection to Africa, even past this point, and we'll get there, obviously. But it's always from this point of view of, like, I don't know, we're working for the greater good here, and we're keeping up those connections so that we can then pull other people into good British society and assimilate them a little further. So again, it's a mixed bag, people. What can I say? Aina's marriage was of national interest. Like, people are lining the streets to catch sight of her, see her and her new husband, and see all the dignitaries who attended the wedding. The procession for the wedding included 10 carriages and 16 bridesmaids. The papers are eating this up. They noted that the wedding party was made up of, quote, white ladies with African gentlemen and African ladies with white gentlemen. So we've got some mixing of the races here, which would be a spectacle at this time. On her marriage certificate, this is, I think, a very important piece of information, Aina actually wrote her first name as Aina. Most often you see it spelled A-I-N-A. She is spelling it I-N-A, so maybe phonetically. And this is assumed to be, you know, her African name, this thing that she's held on to from her childhood, one of the few things that she kind of knows for sure about her origins. So she goes by Sally among her, you know, her white social circles, but maybe Aina is how she would have referred to herself, and we'll never know. But putting it on a marriage certificate, I think, is a way of enshrining that identity and having a little bit of say in the historical record. So we love that for her. Aina and Captain Davies live together in Brighton for a little bit, but his business is really centered in Africa. So they go back to West Africa and they settle in Lagos, Nigeria. Aina teaches in a school there for a while. Her husband is working in various business ventures, kind of building up his influence. And right after the marriage, there's actually a series of pictures taken of both of them. There's solo shots of her and of him, and then there are some joint pictures. They are shot in London by a society photographer, really the, like, celebrity photographer of the day. A man, he's French-born, but he's working in London, named Camille Sylvie. So at this time, you have a picture of what Aina looks like, and I think most interestingly, her husband. In the portraits of her husband, he is holding himself so tall. He's standing so proudly. They are dressed so respectably in really, really fine attire. So these are obviously people of status. And they've got this series of photographs, not just one. You know, it was kind of expensive to have your photo taken, but many, many of them. I'll put a couple of them on the Instagram, but there are a couple more that the National Portrait Gallery has. Now, English Heritage actually suggests in their biography of Ina that it was Queen Victoria who commissioned the pictures for the wedding in 1862. But Captain Davies also would have had the money to do so. And I'm kind of inclined to think it would have been him getting these pictures done as like a status thing, but we might never know. Camille Sylvie, like I said, he was the celebrity photographer of the day. Some of his other subjects included Princess Mary Adelaide of Cambridge, who is mother to Mary of Teck, Queen Emma of Hawaii, the woman's rights advocate Catherine Russell, social thinker Harriet Martineau, and Italian opera singer Adelina Patti. So some high society names are entering his photography studio. Now, Ina and Captain Davies, they're settling in Lagos, Nigeria, and here's a fun fact. She is one of just two native Africans who the British Royal Navy have orders to evacuate in the event of a political uprising in Lagos. So Queen Victoria takes it upon herself to set protection in stone for her goddaughter. She says, any sign of trouble, you get her out of there. And the only other person, I think, was a bishop or like an archbishop. So you have to hope that that also would have extended to her family and not just Ina herself. But that's how highly she was regarded by Queen Victoria. Ina and James have three children, beginning in 1863. They end up having two girls and a boy. The oldest, the firstborn, was a daughter, who Ina named after the queen. She was named Victoria Davies. And of course, when baby Victoria was christened, Victoria the queen was named the child's godmother. Queen Victoria sent a gold cup, a salver, a knife, a fork, and a spoon to Lagos in celebration. When Ina next visited England in December 1867, she presented little baby Victoria to her royal namesake. I think this was at Windsor Castle. Now, Ina and her husband, they lived in Africa until Ina received a diagnosis of tuberculosis. So just like she kind of contracted that chronic cough as an 8-year-old, the thinking is, what can we do to alleviate her symptoms? There's no cure for tuberculosis, unfortunately, but it's thought that like a more moderate temperate climate would help her feel better. So they move to the island of Madeira in hopes of a recovery, and they're there until 1880. Now, unfortunately, in that year, the young Victoria Davies, Ina's daughter, is traveling in England. She is headed to Osborne House to visit Queen Victoria, her godmother, when she learns that her mother has died. Ina passes away from tuberculosis at age 37 in 1880. The Queen is able to give some comfort to Victoria Davies. She wrote in her diary on the occasion, "Saw poor Victoria Davies, my black godchild, who learnt this morning of the death of her dear mother." She also noted that the girl was, quote, "dreadfully upset and distressed. Her father has failed in business, which aggravated her poor mother's illness." Queen Victoria concluded that section saying, "I shall give her an annuity." So she's going to give an allowance to Ina's daughter after the death of her mother. So the Queen pays for Victoria Davies to be educated at Cheltenham Ladies' College, and she stayed in touch with her throughout the rest of her life. I also want to note that everything I've read does not support the idea that James Davies failed in business. I think that was just like a momentary blip, because I've read of him being a philanthropist and an industrialist. So I don't know. I did not go down that rabbit hole, I will also say. Ina was buried in a British ceremony near the Anglican Holy Trinity Church on the island of Madeira. And her husband, Captain Davies, like I said, at this time, he had risen to the level of being a prominent statesman and a philanthropist. He erected a granite obelisk monument in her memory on a cocoa farm that he had started in Lagos. Incidentally, this is credited as being the first cocoa farm in West Africa. He's said to have introduced cocoa farming to Nigeria and the surrounding areas, so that's interesting. This obelisk is over 8 feet tall, and it bears an inscription that says, in part, "In memory of Princess Ina Forbes Bonetta, wife of the Honorable J.P.L. Davies, who departed this life at Madeira, August 15th, 1880, aged 37 years. I don't have a picture of the obelisk on the Instagram, but I do have a picture of her grave in the Holy Trinity Church Cemetery, so you can go take a look at that. Now, Ina's legacy, you can tell, I'm sure, as you've been listening to this episode, it's a tricky one to come to terms with in general. I mean, it's especially tricky for me as a white woman, right? The National Portrait Gallery notes that, quote, "Caught up in Britain's imperial ambitions and plunged into Victorian high society, Ina had crossed immense boundaries between places, cultures, and identities, often without a choice." And that's kind of what I tend to focus on with her story. She succeeded. She entered British society. She became a goddaughter to Queen Victoria, but none of that was by choice. She probably did not imagine that as a destiny for herself. I don't know. What would you rather have? Would you rather, like, get to stay in your homeland and have your parents be alive? Or would you rather be a goddaughter to Queen Victoria? Like, it's an impossible question to answer. But the point is, you're supposed to have the agency to make that decision for yourself. And Ina, sadly, did not. She instead was kind of the subject of this experiment to determine whether Africans could be civilized under British guidance. And that's a really paternalistic point of view, but it was a popular one in the mid-1800s. Victoria's attitude towards her, I do think it was one of genuinely, you know, finding her enjoyable company and taking a liking to her, but that's kind of the root of all of this. That's why she was brought to Britain, I think, at the end of the day. And just to kind of drive home what I mean, like, these people meant well. They meant so well, but there was an account published of Ina's life in December 1880 by the Christian missionary Gleaner. So they published this the year that she dies, and then the next year, 1881, they publish a letter to the editor titled "Queen Victoria's African Protege." So this letter to the editor is written by Annie Schoen, who is the daughter of the missionaries who Ina was placed with when she lived in Kent. Annie noted in this passage that, quote, "On her first coming to us, she was so full of fun and mischief that one was almost reminded of Topsy, by which name, indeed, she sometimes called herself." So, if you're not familiar, Topsy is a fictional character. She's a slave child in the best-selling novel Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. So this is an anti-slavery novel published in 1852. In that book, Topsy is like this young child. She's purchased out of like an abusive situation, but she's enslaved and she's purchased, like she's bought with money. She's given to a white woman who attempts to raise her and teach her Christian values. Initially, Topsy is painted as like entirely ignorant. She misbehaves, and characters in the book regard her as this pitiful creature. The New York Public Library says that Topsy, quote, "needs corrective whippings and consistent instruction to behave because she has no family and simply does not know better." And that would have been the view of the people in the novel, the other characters. It's only after befriending a white child, it's been years since I like read or pretended to read Uncle Tom's Cabin, but I think the girl's name is Eva, the white child who's kind of the foil to Topsy. And she kind of learns what love is by knowing Eva. It's only through that Topsy, quote unquote, accepts Christian teachings, and she gets to move north with her white guardian, who eventually purchases Topsy and gives her her freedom, and treats her then as a daughter. So it's this weird story. Like, abolitionists at the time actually had problems with it because, you know, it's this idea of Christian redemption, yes, enabling us to be saved, but that's not necessarily a lens you should put over somebody's life when they're born into slavery. Like, they don't have to deserve being freed from enslavement. That's not how this works. So it's interesting to me that is what Annie Schoen chooses to associate Ina with. And apparently, you know, Ina calls herself Topsy, according to this account. Like I said, this account is written after Ina's death. So again, we don't have any evidence to back it up. She could just be saying this to appeal to this abolitionist audience, but or this Christian missionary audience, such that it is. But Annie interestingly closes the account by saying she talks about the last time she saw Ina and says that she, quote, looks forward to the time when, amidst the great multitude whom no man can remember, from all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, I may meet her before the throne and join with her in singing the everlasting song of praise unto him that sitteth upon the throne and unto the Lamb forever and ever. So she's saying she will meet Ina again in heaven, which is really, again, underlying the entire point here, that there's this Christian undertone to the benevolence that Ina was given by the Schoen family, which really, I think, puts it all into perspective here. So, yeah, Ina's story, like many stories of Black Britons, are difficult for us to fully comprehend, and that is something that heritage organizations and museums, like, continue to grapple with. So that brings us to the portrait of Ina that was produced in 2020. It comes out of a project by English Heritage. They announced in October 2020 that they had, quote, commissioned a series of portraits depicting six historic figures from the African diaspora whose stories have contributed to England's rich history. So these were going to be portraits of figures, quote, associated with the charity's sites and whose stories, like Benetta's, have been previously overlooked. And they would be painted by six different artists. These portraits included figures from, like, all across society, from the top to the bottom of British society. They included Rome's African-born emperor, Septimius Severus, who was the person who strengthened Hadrian's Wall, as well as a man named James Chappelle, a 17th century servant at Kirby Hall in Northamptonshire, who saved the life of the hall's owner. So kind of running the gamut here of Black figures from British history. Incidentally, another subject in this exhibition was Dido Elizabeth Bell, who is the subject of the third episode on the Art of History podcast. If you haven't heard her story, you should go listen to it. Dido was painted by London-based Jamaican artist Michaela Henry Lowe Bell, and she was the daughter of an enslaved Black woman and a Royal Navy officer who was raised in this aristocratic family in Georgian-era London. So all of these portraits that were created would then be exhibited at these heritage sites, these estates, these buildings that have connections to them. So Dido's portrait was displayed at Kenwood, which was home to, oh gosh, it's been ages since I had done this research on her. I think it was her uncle, Lord Mansfield, who was also the Lord Chief Justice, the man who made a, quote, significant contribution along the road to abolition. So again, if you'd like to hear more about Dido and her story, that is the third episode of this podcast. Can't vouch for the quality because I had no idea what I was doing back then, but it's a good story. English Heritage said that each artist was supported by our curators and historians to creatively portray their subject. So Ina's portrait is on display at Osborne House, which is Queen Victoria's, like, private seaside home on the Isle of Wight. She lived there with Prince Albert and their nine children. Ina did visit the Queen at Osborne House a number of times during her life, so that's the connection between the place where her portrait is displayed. The artist who completed Ina's portrait, Hannah Uzor, said that, quote, through my art, I'm interested in exploring those forgotten Black people in British history, people such as Ina. What I find interesting about Ina is that she challenges our assumptions about the status of Black women in Victorian Britain. I was also drawn to her because of the parallels with my own family and my children who share Ina's Nigerian heritage. So Hannah Uzor herself, she is a British artist. She was born in Zambia. Her portrait of Ina was actually part of a larger 2020 project of hers, which covered the Victorian era in the United Kingdom. She used portraiture and video as a tool to highlight the stories of the individuals, quote, belonging to the African diaspora and the complex relationships they had with Western society and culture. To complete Ina's portrait, Uzor spent a lot of time in the archives. She did research, she read through all of the documentation on Ina's life in order to she said she wanted to bring her to life on the canvas. So the documentation on Ina, of course, is much more plentiful because of her royal status and her connection to Queen Victoria. we would not know so much about her life if she hadn't kind of been taken under Queen Victoria's wing. Through this process, Hannah Uzor said that she got a feel for Ida's personality because it kind of peeked through the accounts and, you know, the letters that we do have and the historical documents. So the portrait, it's beautiful. If you have not yet gone over to the Instagram or looked it up, please do so. It's a full-length portrait. It is based on a solo photograph by Camille Sylvie that the National Portrait Gallery in London actually owns. So the pose is the same. She has this prop in the portrait that I'll talk about in a minute. That's exactly the same as in the picture. But it's just Ina in her wedding dress against this very saturated teal turquoise blue background. So she's kind of outlined, and it's obviously very visually striking. The painting is actually mixed media, meaning that Hannah Uzor, yes, used paint, but she also mixed in other materials. So in this case, she used actual pieces of fabric on Ina's skirt. So you can see it around the bottom part of her skirt. It's actually three-dimensional. And she said that she included this detail to invite the viewer to question what they were looking at. So you walk into Osborne House. She said that's a place where you're surrounded by like artifacts from empire and colonialism. And you're confronted with this portrait of a Black woman in a pose and in clothing that's more typically seen on Victorian white women, you know, these white ladies. And so the fabric is this tie-in that pulls you in from the three dimensions to the two, and it helps you to kind of know that you're looking at a modern depiction of somebody, but you also want to look closer, and the thinking is that that then leads you to learn more and want to look closer at Ina's story herself. I think that's a really clever detail. Hannah Uzor also picked up on the prop that Ina is placed with in the original photograph by Camille Sylvie. She is kind of standing, like, facing, so her right side is facing out of the canvas. So she would be facing, like, to the right, but then she turns her head to look out of the canvas at us. And in front of her is this chair, and on it is a book. So Hannah Uzor interprets this as being a reference to Ina's education and the fact that she was well-read, she was cultured, she was a cultivated lady, you know? So she chose to keep that in this otherwise completely blank portrait of Ina, and I love that as well. She also has this very regal gaze. She's looking kind of, not looking down at us, but she's very firm in her stance, and she's very firm in her facial features. And Hannah Uzor said that gaze was particularly important to her as she was kind of depicting Ina, because she got a feel for her subject's strength and resilience through her process of research. She said, quote, "She's owning her space as a Black woman who has both African heritage and British heritage." And for Uzor, that is kind of the point here. She spoke on the English Heritage podcast about the process of painting this. I'll link the episode in the episode description here because it's a good listen, like a companion piece to this episode. How many times can I say episode in one sentence? Jeez. But Hannah Uzor said that Ina's story and depicting her as this woman who owns her space allows us to question what it means to be Black British, especially in this day and age. And this depiction also challenges assumptions that people might have about people with African heritage, particularly because Black history isn't really taught in conjunction with the wider history of England. Many white Britons have this preconceived notion, or may have in the past, it's obviously better now, but there's this idea that like diverse people only came to the UK in like the last 100 years, right? Often we see this portrayal of diverse groups of people, minorities, first arriving like after World War II to help with the cleanup and the rebuilding effort. And that's not reality. The reality is that they've been there all along. You know, they're part of the fabric of British history, and Black history is British history. It's also American history. So, so that's kind of the undertone of this portrait for Hannah Uzor. Concurring with that, Anna Evis, the English Heritage curatorial director, says, quote, starting with Ina, our portraits project is one way we're bringing these stories to life and sharing them with our visitors. Black history is part of English history, and while we know we have more to do, English Heritage is committed to telling the story of England in full. Our portrait series, Celebrating Black Lives from the Past, is part of a program of work that includes in-depth research into the links between the slave trade and the sites in our care. So English Heritage is the organization that kind of looks after different houses and places around the UK. From next year, new interpretation at relevant sites will bring those links to the fore. And once again, Uzor says, quote, to see Ina return to Osborne, her godmother's home, is very satisfying, and I hope my portrait will mean more people discover her story. So she's really the missing piece for Hannah Uzor and for visitors to places like Osborne House. You know, you might go there attempting to learn more about Queen Victoria, expecting to see these like colonial artifacts, these depictions of like glory for the British Empire, but now Hannah Uzor has brought this missing puzzle piece back into the story. So she says that, you know, we finally have this complete picture of British history now that we've added this depiction and these portraits of Black Britons back in. So it's a really beautiful thing. And it's something that we, in the art history world, in the museum world, in the heritage world, we all need more of that. So I love this portrait for that reason. I hope you love it too. There are a couple of books about Ina if you would like to read her biography. They're out there. Also, there's a potential movie on the horizon. However, it was announced in 2020, so I have no clue what's happening with it. COVID has killed so many things that I would love to have seen come to fruition, and this might have been one of them. I'm not sure. So in 2020, it was reported that Cynthia Erivo was going to produce and star in a biopic on Ina. I mean, how incredible would that have been? Benedict Cumberbatch was set to executive produce. I'm really nervous that this project has been shelved. I have not seen any updates on it since 2020. I've also heard nothing about it being canceled, so it could still be in production. I don't know. If anyone has insider info, please get in touch with me. Cynthia Erivo, if you're listening, before the Wicked press tour ramps up, just give me a call. Let me know. I would love to watch that movie. Please make it. At the time, Cynthia Erivo said of Ina, she said, quote, as a Nigerian British woman, to get the opportunity to tell the story of another Nigerian British woman who until now has been erased from the history books is an honor. Miss Sarah Forbes Benetta, Amoba Ina, is truly a passion of mine, and I'm so pleased to have been able to find partners to tell the story and finally give her a voice. I cannot wait to dive into her story. She is indeed the forgotten princess, forgotten no more. And I think that's what this is all about. You know, even though stories like Ina's, they're hard for us to grapple with as modern audiences who want to think of colonialism and slavery as like firmly in the past, but these legacies of these stories matter, and talking about them, bringing new life to these stories and weaving them back into our history is so important. So I hope I was able to do her justice. I hope you enjoyed learning about her if you had never met Miss Ina Sarah Forbes Benetta before. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, all of those good things. It really does help us get in front of new listeners. You can also listen to me on the podcast Lady Audacity, TEA, if you would like to hear me rant and rave about the royals, because they've been continuing to make the news. And I continue to make my own royal commentary videos at Matta of Fact on Instagram and TikTok. Links for everything always in the description. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Art of History Podcast. And you can send us an email, of course, at artofhistorypod@gmail.com. I'm always fielding suggestions over there for subjects to cover, paintings to look at. Get in touch. Send me a DM. Send me an email. Let me know what you think. Please be nice. And with that, I will see you in the next one.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.